Barrett let it be known that the First Lady was dissatisfied with the way Gibbs had handled the matter. As Jody Kantor recounts in The Obamas, Gibbs blew his stack. "Fuck this. That's not right. I've been killing myself on this. Where's this coming from?" he bellowed. "What is it she has concerns about? What did she say to you?" Jarrett offered a vague response. "What the fuck do you mean?" Gibbs said. "Did you ask her?" Jarrett explained that the denial from the Elysee Palace had not come fast enough. "Why is she talking to you about it?" Gibbs demanded to know. "If she has a problem, she should talk to me." "You shouldn't talk that way," Jarrett said. "You don't know what the fuck you're talking about," Gibbs said. "The First Lady would not believe you're speaking this way," Jarrett said. "Then fuck her too," Gibbs said. Michelle's interference in White House policy was also a touchy subject with Rahm Emanuel when he was chief of staff. He and the First Lady had never gotten along. They were the yin and yang of the White House, frequently on opposite sides of an issue. They gave each other a wide berth, but still grated on each other's nerves. Emanuel particularly resented the fact that the First Lady sent scolding emails to Alyssa Mastromonaco, the president's director of scheduling, and that these emails were passed around the White House, undercutting his authority. When the Washington Post ran a story saying that Emanuel was trying to save the president from his amateurish inclinations, "Why Obama Needs Rahm at the Top," it was assumed that the chief of staff, who was famous for calling reporters, had leaked the story. As a result, his stock fell to a new low with Michelle. In January 2010, the Democrats lost Edward Kennedy's Senate seat from Massachusetts, costing the party its filibuster-proof majority and dooming Obama's chances of passing legislation for a government-run single-payer healthcare system. Michelle was fit to be tied. She couldn't understand why the president's advisors had failed to read the political tea leaves in Massachusetts, or why they had sent Obama to Massachusetts at the 11th hour on a fruitless mission to save Martha Coakley, the inept Democratic candidate. The whole thing smacked of amateurism, and according to several sources, Michelle told the president that he needed a new team of advisors, starting with Rahm Emanuel. "She feels as if our rudder isn't set right," the president told his aides. When Emanuel heard that, he strode into the Oval Office and offered his resignation. It was turned down. But by then, Emanuel's days were numbered. From time to time, Michelle did impulsive, silly things that spoiled her carefully crafted image. At such moments, her handlers were forced to launch one of their frequent PR makeovers. This practice first became apparent right after Barack Obama won the Democratic nomination in June 2008. Voters still held serious reservations about his wife, who seemed to take pleasure in demeaning the candidate and mocking his stinky morning breath. As Kate Betts wrote in Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style, her approval rating lingered at 43%. Something had to be done. Political dreams had been dashed on less daunting obstacles than an unpopular spouse. With a savvy sense of what was necessary and no hint of strain, in a matter of weeks, Michelle Obama appeared to make a mid-course correction. She changed the content and tone of her speeches. She changed the way she dressed. She replaced the corporate armor of sleek jackets and pantsuits with soft cardigans and June Cleaver-esque 1950-style floral print dresses. On the surface, it looked as if Michelle Obama was swapping power woman for power wife. As Michelle began to substitute homey anecdotes about tucking her kids into bed at night for stump speeches about public policy, she made parallel adjustments to her wardrobe, softening her look and enhancing the idea of accessibility through her clothing. Her approval rating started to rise. At the end of August 2009, they had climbed to 53%. Another example of Michelle's impulsive, narcissistic nature was her decision to go on a lavish vacation to Spain in the summer of 2010 at the height of the Great Recession, even though practically her entire staff advised against it. She overruled them and flew off on an Air Force 757, along with three shifts of uniformed plainclothes agents and military personnel. Her security entourage numbered 70 people. Her vast army of support personnel checked into the Via Padierna Palace Hotel in Marbella, a five-star resort on the Spanish Costa del Sol. The trip cost American taxpayers several hundred thousand dollars, and the backlash was harsh and immediate. A column by Andrea Tantaros in the New York Daily News was headlined, "Material Girl Michelle Obama is a modern-day Marie Antoinette on a glitzy Spanish vacation." Though the trip to Spain garnered most of the publicity, it was hardly Michelle's only foray into expensive vacations. Between August 2010 and August 2011, she spent a total of 42 days on vacation, or one out of every 9 days. During the same period of time, the number of Americans on food stamps increased from 32 to 46 million. In February 2012, just weeks after a 17-day Christmas vacation in Hawaii, Michelle decided she needed another break. With gas prices at an historic winter high, the government struggling to cut the federal deficit, and many American families foregoing their annual holiday vacations, Michelle thumbed her nose at political convention and jetted off with Sasha and Malia on President's Day weekend for the upmarket ski slopes of Aspen, Colorado. Several people have known about the low-key vacation, with the Secret Service in town for the past few days scoping out places for the family to relax and enjoy what the resort has to offer, wrote Aspen Daily News columnist Carolyn Zachariasen. Pritkin County Sheriff Joe DeSalvo confirmed that he has met with the Secret Service and has loaned 7 deputies to help protect the First Lady and her family. The question naturally arises, why would someone who is as politically savvy as Michelle Obama do such foolish things? The answer seems to lie in Michelle's personality, which is acquisitive and materialistic by nature. For her 44th birthday, Obama bought his wife something she had long coveted, a set of diamond stud earrings. He spent $5,000. She promptly returned them in exchange for bigger diamonds that cost $12,000. Michelle has expensive tastes, writes Carol Felsenthal in ChicagoMag.com. It was she who wanted to trade up from their two-bedroom condominium on the first floor of a three-story walk-up, for which they had paid $277,500 in 1993, to the $1.65 million six-bedroom Georgian Revival Kenwood mansion that landed them in a deal with the wife of Tony Rezko, the convicted felon and fundraiser fixer. As a high-maintenance woman, Michelle feels right at home in the White House. "It's a cool time in her life," says a journalist who is assigned to follow the First Lady full-time. "She doesn't have to work hard. She has more help. She's treated like a queen. She never has to worry about money again. She has a contract to write a book about a year in the life of the White House garden." "Nowadays," continues the journalist, "Michelle doesn't have much stuff to nag Barack about. After all, he's home for dinner most nights of the week. The kids are in a good place. She's home when the kids come home. She's shown the girls the world. She has time for tennis lessons and workouts. She spends a good part of the day working out in the gym, picking out her wardrobe and doing her makeup. She's living in a dream world. You know that old saying, when mom's happy, everyone's happy." Chapter 12. Out to Lunch. Politics is all about relationships, people. A lot of it's emotional. It's not rocket science. Former White House Chief of Staff William M. Daley. When Barack Obama appointed Bill Daley as his new Chief of Staff in January 2011, the bald, genial Chicagoan was widely expected to be a welcome change from the ruthlessly aggressive Rahm Emanuel. A world-class schmoozer and political fixer, Daley was weaned on politics. He is the son of the legendary Mayor Richard J. Daley and the brother of Mayor Richard M. Daley. Thanks in large part to his family connections, Bill Daley was appointed as Commerce Secretary in the Clinton administration and later became head of the Office of Corporate Responsibility for J.P. Morgan Chase, which in practice meant he spent a lot of time wining and dining the bank's clients. With Daley's experience in both the public and private sectors, and his genuinely warm personality, it was hoped that he would smooth Obama's frayed relationships with the business community and Congress, and bring a grown-up centrist sensibility to a White House that was populated by a crew of cloistered left-wing amateurs. It didn't happen. What everyone in the White House had overlooked was that Daley had little legislative experience. Predictably enough, his honeymoon lasted less than a year, a tumultuous year in which he failed to help Obama reach a bipartisan grand bargain with the House of Representatives on reducing the federal budget deficit, and allowed the president to engage in a degrading mud wrestle with congressional Republicans over raising the debt ceiling. These raucous ideological arguments left Obama looking weaker than ever, and Valerie Jarrett, who was expert in enhancing her power by finding fault with others, pointed a finger of blame at Daley for failing to protect the president from the political fallout. After getting an earful of anti-Daley static, Obama lost faith in his chief of staff and transferred most of his management responsibilities to Pete Rouse, a longtime aide and political strategist. The hapless Daley was unceremoniously relegated to the sidelines in the West Wing. By the fall of 2011, as the White House geared up for what was expected to be a massively expensive and brutally negative presidential campaign, Daley felt that his usefulness to the president had come to an end. But he kept his feelings to himself. He deeply resented the role Jarrett had played in his downfall, and before he left his post, he wanted to engage her in one last battle. A fierce debate had been rocking the White House over a proposal to require church-run hospitals and universities to give their employees free contraception. Jarrett, along with Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, favored the plan. But Bill Daley and Vice President Biden, both Catholics with intimate ties to the church hierarchy, opposed the mandate, arguing that it breached the separation of church and state and would lose the president Catholic votes. With Biden's approval, Daley secretly arranged an Oval Office meeting between Obama and New York Archbishop Timothy Dolan, the head of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, who argued that the policy violated the principle of religious freedom. Daley knew he was running a risk by scheduling such a meeting. Obama didn't like to hear anyone tell him that he was wrong, and White House sources later revealed that the president had felt uncomfortable being put on the spot by Dolan, who would shortly be elevated to cardinal. However, Obama's discomfort was nothing compared to Valerie Jarrett's. She hadn't been informed about the meeting, and when she learned about Daley's end run, she went to the president and vented her anger. Obama faced a major rift among his closest advisors on an immensely sensitive social issue. Who should he back? On one side stood Daley, Biden, and Nancy Ann DeParle, the deputy chief of staff who had coordinated the passage of Obamacare, but opposed the contraceptive mandate because, she argued, it would lose Obama the support of liberal as well as conservative Catholics. On the other side stood Jarrett, Sebelius, and David Plouffe, who had replaced David Axelrod as Obama's senior in-house political advisor, and argued that since most Catholics flouted the church's dictates on birth control, they wouldn't penalize Obama at the ballot box. Largely lost in the debate was a simple fact. A mandate forcing religious institutions to go against their beliefs and conscience and offer contraception was constitutionally wrong and politically stupid. That, however, didn't stop Obama from announcing he was going ahead with the mandate, thereby pleasing his Democratic base and adding another victory in his crusade to move America to the left. His victory dance was short-lived, however, for within a matter of weeks, he had to revise his original proposal to quiet the political storm that he had unleashed. In January 2012, a disgusted Bill Daley abruptly resigned, embarrassing the president. Obama called a hasty press conference and, grim-faced, announced his new and fourth, counting Pete Rouse, who served in an interim role between Emanuel and Daley, chief of staff, Jacob Lew, the obscure White House budget director. It was a new low, even for Barack Obama. The Daley debacle underscored a truth universally acknowledged by Obama's friends and adversaries, namely, that after more than 3 years in office, his administration was still amateurish and in disarray. The inability of Daley, with all his people skills, to bridge some of the differences between the White House and Congress emphasized just how isolated and out of touch Obama and his team were from the realities of Washington. Every modern president, perhaps with the exception of Gerry Ford, entered the White House with a large quotient of self-assurance and arrogance, a top aide to the Republican House leadership told me, speaking on the condition of anonymity. But what makes this president unique is that he is so beyond that. Not only is he self-assured, the smartest guy in the room, but in his estimation, all he has to do is state something, and the scales will fall from your eyes. Despite the storyline people create, that he is a thoughtful, non-ideological compromiser, he has a distinct leftist ideology and can't make a decision that takes him out of his comfort zone. My first experience with him was in January 2010, just after his State of the Union speech, when we went to the White House for a bicameral meeting in the cabinet room, the Republican aide continued. The president said he needed to find common cause on his cap-and-trade energy policy. He said, "I've taken on my party by being pro-nuclear, so now you have to give me cap-and-trade." By that, he meant he was willing to lift the ban on the construction of nuclear energy sites. But in fact, he hadn't taken any substantive position on nuclear power. It was just words. Not long after that, there was another meeting in the cabinet room. This time the president said, "The economy is not doing all that bad. You guys, the Republicans, have to stop being negative." And Speaker of the House John Boehner said, "Mr. President, the problem with the economy is the uncertainty on taxes, cap and trade, and health care. Until there is certainty, businesses are not going to invest." And the president slapped his hand on the table and said, "You're wrong. I talk to CEOs all the time, and they tell me the problem is Washington doesn't work." Of course, by that, he meant that Washington didn't work the way he wanted it to work. He's got so little appreciation and knowledge of how Congress works that it's an equal branch of government. If you challenge him, he's furious. He gives you the death stare. He has no close relationship with any member of the Senate, and certainly not in the House. John Boehner says that, in his 20 years in Washington, he's been through four administrations, and that this one is completely opaque. He doesn't know who makes the decisions and how they make them in the Obama White House. All this goes back to the fact that Obama is a leftist. He doesn't understand that the way to make this town work, both sides have to get up from the table thinking that they've won something. This White House is incapable of doing that. It wasn't only Republicans who found Barack Obama infuriatingly out of touch. Even the mainstream media, which had fawned over Obama for the better part of 3 years, began to wake up to the truth. "This president," wrote the Washington Post's Scott Wilson, "endures with little joy the small talk and backslapping of retail politics, rarely spends more than a few minutes on a rope line, refuses to coddle even his biggest donors. His relationship with Democrats on Capitol Hill is frosty, to be generous. Personal lobbying on behalf of legislation? He prefers to leave that to Vice President Joe Biden, an old-school political charmer." "Obama's isolation," Wilson continued, "is increasingly relevant as the 2012 campaign takes shape, because it is pushing him toward a re-election strategy that embraces the narrow-caste politics he once rejected as beneath him. Now he is focused on securing the support of traditional Democratic allies: minorities, gays, young people, seniors, Jews, rather than on making new friends. If Obama's re-election strategy depended on the kindness of old friends, he was in for a disappointment. With the exception of union leaders like Andy Stern, the former president of the 2.2 million member Service Employees International Union, who had visited the White House more than 50 times, most of the president's major supporters had been given the brush off and were nursing bruised egos. This was especially true of high-profile Democrats like Oprah Winfrey, Carolyn Kennedy, and leading members of the Jewish community, all of whom have been snubbed by the Obama White House. Indeed, one of the most important stories in Washington was just how angry and disillusioned these Democratic luminaries were with the President and First Lady. A critical question hovering over the 2012 presidential campaign was whether these one-time friends would return to the Obama fold. Part 3. With friends like these. We walk alone in the world. Friends, such as we desire, are dreams and fables. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Chapter 13. Oprah's Sacrifice. Oprah is from the world of Christmas, mystical, cheerful, appealing, even beguiling. She is no policy wonk, but is cast well as a black, female Saint Nick, bringing joy to the world. Her endorsement softens Obama, wraps him up, and makes of him a Christmas present to America. Dick Morris. Shortly after the 2008 presidential election, Oprah Winfrey traveled to Washington, D.C., to nail down an interview for O, the Oprah magazine, with Michelle Obama. Oprah expected the president-elect and his wife to give her a reception fit for visiting royalty, and for the occasion, she took along Gail King, the magazine's editor-at-large and her constant companion. More than a year and a half had passed since Oprah announced that she was throwing her support behind Barack Obama in his primary race against Hillary Clinton. The endorsement had represented a calculated risk for the queen of daytime television. It was one thing for her to recommend a book or launch the career of Dr. Phil, but it was quite for her to back a political candidate. Oprah worried that her audience, which represented a broad economic, cultural, and political spectrum of American women, would resent her becoming a partisan for a political candidate. As it turned out, a sizable chunk of her audience took offense and stopped watching her show. No sooner had Oprah hit the campaign trail, appearing beside Obama at one primary rally after another, than her personal favorability ratings began to slide, falling from 74% to 66%. Her unfavorable ratings suffered an even worse fate. They jumped from 17% to 26%. Most important, her endorsement of Obama caused a significant drop in the ratings of her TV show and in the rates that she could charge advertisers. Was the sacrifice worth it? As an entertainer and businesswoman, Oprah had suffered a setback. But she felt proud that she had been instrumental in electing the first black president of the United States, and she believed that she had earned a place in the president-elect's brain trust. As the New York Times editorialized, her early and enthusiastic endorsement of Senator Obama played a big role in winning over bit parts of middle America to the Obama cause. Two economists at the University of Maryland, College Park, estimated that Oprah's endorsement netted Obama 1,015,559 votes and decided the primary election. And the Pew Research Center found that Oprah's appearance on the stage with Obama made him more acceptable to African-American voters, some of whom had wondered if he was black enough. During the early weeks of the presidential transition, as Obama stitched together his new White House team, he appeared to embrace Oprah as one of his trusted advisors. When she phoned, he dropped everything and took her call. They huddled over strategy. Of all of Obama's unofficial White House advisors, Oprah had unparalleled access, input, influence, and power. However, by the time Oprah and Gail landed in Washington a month after the election, Oprah's relationship with the Obamas had come unglued. Oprah had tried to ignore the ominous change in tone coming from the Obama transition team. As Barack Obama's inauguration drew near, Oprah's calls to Michelle went unreturned. Instead, Oprah heard from Max Dobler, the newly appointed White House ceremonies coordinator, who told Oprah that she needed to talk to him first about the interview. What's more, Dobler said, Oprah had to run her interview questions past Jeff Stevens, a deputy speechwriter, for prior approval. It was a pain as far as Oprah was concerned, said a high-ranking executive of Harpo Studios, Oprah's production company. Oprah isn't a snob, but she doesn't like having to put up with mid-level clerks. These guys were $75,000-a-year men. Oprah was like, hello, what is this shit? But she did it. She went to Washington with Gail and met with both Dobler and Stevens to hash out the details. I was surprised that she went there, hat in hand. It soon became apparent that something had gone wrong between Oprah and the new administration, or, more precisely, between Oprah and Michelle Obama. The problem seemed to originate from two of Michelle's advisors, Valerie Jarrett and Desiree Rogers, the new White House social secretary. They resented Oprah's meddling in their bailiwick. Among other things, Oprah had a plan to redecorate the Lincoln bedroom. She also had ideas about how Michelle could put more zing into White House social events. As the person who controlled access to the first couple, Valerie Jarrett saw Oprah as a potential threat to her power. If Oprah went unchecked, she would bypass Valerie and go directly to the president and first lady. What good was it being the gatekeeper if you couldn't lock the gate when you wanted? And so Valerie set about turning Michelle against Oprah. Oprah was too close to the president. Oprah was acting like she was the first lady. Oprah didn't know her place. Oprah was a bad influence. Valerie advised Michelle to distance herself from Oprah and cut her out of the White House inner circle. It didn't take much to convince Michelle. As Michelle knew only too well, her husband had a compelling need to win the approval of strong women like Oprah. He seemed to be in awe of the talk show host, sometimes giving her advice priority over Michelle's. For instance, Oprah thought that Obama was overexposing himself on television and told him to pull back. Though Michelle disagreed, Obama listened to Oprah and restricted his TV appearances. As far as Michelle was concerned, Oprah's billions and her elite lifestyle disqualified her as an advisor to Barack, who had no truck with wealthy people, except as a source of campaign contributions, and was a redistributionist at heart. There was another reason for Michelle's negative attitude toward Oprah. Michelle is very jealous, I would say unusually so, said someone who was very close to Oprah. Most people after years of marriage have trust and don't follow their husbands around and check on them. Michelle doesn't seem to trust Barack at all. She insists on knowing his every movement and drops in on him at all kinds of odd times. It's been the buzz of the White House. Oprah has gossiped about it and giggled about how obsessive Michelle is. This is what she hears from her friends who work in the East Wing, and believe me, she has some good sources. Everybody wants to be Oprah's source, and she loves gossip. Michelle makes it clear to her inner circle, and this certainly includes Valerie, that she wants women around Barack watched and wants info about who he has an eye for and gets touchy with, this person continued. The thing is, she knows, like everybody, about JFK's shenanigans, and she thinks, hey, JFK was young and good-looking like my guy. Michelle talked to Gail King about it, just talking as friends. She has become much closer to Gail than to Oprah, to Oprah's anger and surprise. She told Gail that if she found out her husband was running around, she wouldn't keep quiet. Gail was kind of astonished that she would say that. Eventually, Oprah got a green light for her interview, and on February 17, 2009, she and Gail climbed into Oprah's custom-built $42 million Bombardier Global Express XRS and jetted off to Washington. The women had talked about having Oprah's $335,000 Bentley Azure convertible pick them up at Reagan National Airport and drive them to the White House with the top down, even though it was a cold, cloudy day with the temperature in the 30s. But it occurred to them that Michelle wasn't going to be waiting at the front door of the White House and wouldn't notice their grand entrance. Footnote. Aware of Michelle's expensive tastes, Oprah made a point of wearing her $117,000 Cartier Diablo watch to the White House meeting with the First Lady. So they ditched the Bentley idea and counted on the White House sending a Suburban and driver to meet them at the airport. But that didn't happen either. Instead, Oprah had to pay for a limo ride to the White House. When they arrived, Oprah and Gail weren't treated like VIPs. They were made to wait at the security gate, like ordinary visitors. Once inside, they had to cool their heels for a long time before they were shown up to the yellow oval room in the family residence, where Michelle finally made an appearance. Michelle told Oprah and Gail what great light the room got, said a Harpo executive who spoke to Oprah later about the meeting. But it was a grim, overcast, washed-out sort of day. Michelle also told them how great it was to be waited on by a large staff, as if Oprah wouldn't know about that. And oddly enough, Michelle mentioned that the White House cooks made the best pie in the world, but she didn't offer Oprah or Gail any. It was almost an act of cruelty. Instead, she served them almonds, not an Oprah fave. Michelle seemed to direct her answers and asides to Gail rather than Oprah, the Harpo exec continued. It made both Oprah and Gail very uncomfortable, which may have been the idea. Oprah struck back by asking Michelle whether she and the president were still fighting a lot. Taken aback by such a personal question, Michelle stumbled, then finally managed to say that the marital arguing had been a growth point in their relationship. Months later, when Michelle announced she was going to devote herself to fighting childhood obesity, Oprah offered to pitch in. She sent word to Michelle that she would love to have her on her TV show, where Michelle could tell millions of viewers about healthy nutrition for their children and families. Oprah also wanted to broadcast a show from the White House on the subject of exercise and weight control. Once again, Oprah waited in vain for a response from the White House. When an answer finally arrived, it was curt to the point of rudeness. That wouldn't fit into the First Lady's plans. According to sources for this book, Oprah told Gail King that she felt like getting Michelle on the phone and really letting her have it. Oprah raged, "Michelle hates fat people and doesn't want me waddling around the White House." Eventually, Gail convinced Oprah to let her draft a diplomatic note expressing Oprah's disappointment. But an Oprah aide, who was close to several members of the White House staff, learned that Michelle treated Gail's letter with scorn. "Oprah only wants to cash in, using the White House as a backdrop for her show to perk up her ratings," Michelle was quoted as telling her staff. "Oprah, with her yo-yo dieting and huge girth, is a terrible role model. Kids will look at Oprah, who's rich and famous and huge, and figure it's okay to be fat." Oprah went through the roof when she heard about Michelle's remarks. "If Michelle thinks I need more fame and money," said Oprah, "she's nuts." I asked a White House insider to explain Michelle's animus toward Oprah. "Michelle is furious that her husband makes late-night calls to Oprah, seeking ideas on how to improve his sinking popularity," the source told me. "Michelle thinks he should turn to her, not Oprah, for that kind of advice." What's more, Michelle suspects that at one point Oprah secretly encouraged Hillary to consider a run against Barack in the 2012 Democratic primaries. Barack just laughs at the idea, and so does Oprah. But Michelle still believes Oprah has been getting too close to Hillary, whom Michelle calls a snake. Nonetheless, the president pushed Michelle, against her will, to make a sort of peace with Oprah in order to get Oprah's endorsement in 2012. Left with little choice, Michelle reluctantly agreed to tape an interview for one of the last Oprah TV shows in May 2011. She sat there through much of the show with her arms folded in a defensive posture across her chest. Will Oprah support Barack Obama in his second run for the White House? And if so, will she expend the same energy and enthusiasm that she exhibited the first time around? Those questions could be asked not only of Oprah, but of Obama's other key supporters and fundraisers from the 2008 election. For many of them, disillusionment has replaced the old fire in their belly. 3.5 years of aloofness, non-communication, and dithering amateurism by the president left his old shock troops in a state of shock. Obama's campaign staff has scrambled to repair the damage and convince these important Democrats that the president will be more considerate of their views in the future. Obama campaign headquarters in Chicago has dialed up a charm offensive, and Democrats who hadn't heard from the president for months, or even years, were showered with sudden invitations to the White House. Despite all this, rumors persisted that Oprah would sit out the 2012 election. When I asked Gayle King about that, she told me, "Ed, we have every intention of supporting the president for re-election." But the question still remained whether Oprah would run the risk of further alienating her audience by going beyond a verbal endorsement and actively campaigning for Obama. Since leaving her syndicated talk show and launching OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network, Oprah has been struggling with anemic ratings. She and her backers have lost tens of millions of dollars and have been searching for new investors. By closely associating herself with Barack Obama, she might complicate her efforts to save OWN. In any case, after suffering repeated snubs from Michelle, it seems likely that this time around, Oprah Winfrey would play it safe and put her business interests before politics. Chapter 14. Snubbing Caroline. "I mean, Caroline Kennedy? Come on. She's part of history." Michelle Obama. It was toward the end of June 2009, and the weather in Hyannisport had turned grim and chilling. Senator Edward M. Kennedy, who was suffering from the final stages of incurable brain cancer, had just returned from an excursion on his beloved sailboat, the Maya. His wife, Victoria Reggie, was waiting for him in a golf cart at the windswept dock. Two burly aides lifted Ted out of the boat and placed him gently beside his wife. The couple then drove to a large tent, where almost 100 members of the Kennedy clan had gathered near the home of Ethel Kennedy for a birthday party for two of her grandchildren. It was a rare gathering of the extended family, the wife of one of Ethel's sons said in an interview for this book. "That kind of thing only happens now at funerals. The family is very divided and spread out. The Hyannisport compound thing is fading fast." "It was a weird occasion," she continued. "In a way, it was to say farewell to Ted. But in Ted's eyes, it was to heal a rift in the family, which was divided over its support for the newly elected president, Barack Obama. Ted, of course, had enthusiastically endorsed Obama during the primary campaign and general election, calling Obama a man with extraordinary gifts of leadership and character. And Caroline Kennedy said that Obama offered the same sense of hope and inspiration as her father. But there were naysayers present at Hyannisport, notably Bobby, Robert Kennedy Jr., who had been all for Hillary and was still a bitter critic of Obama. Ted wanted to convince the family to speak with one voice, so that they would have more political power in the future. It was the kind of advice his dad, old Joe Kennedy, would have given. It was a huge thing for Ted, something he was willing to spend his last breath on. Frail though he was, Ted was eager to take the fight directly to Bobby, who, along with his sisters, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend and Carrie Kennedy, led the family faction that had supported Hillary. There had always been tensions at Kennedy family gatherings. Fistfights and overturned tables were not unheard of, and this event was no exception. Bobby told his uncle, in no uncertain terms, that he deeply resented the outrageous way the Obama people had tried to hang the charge of racism on Bill Clinton. For Bobby, like his father, Robert F. Kennedy, everything was personal. Bobby had two children who suffered from asthma, and he didn't think Obama took environmental issues like air quality seriously enough. Bobby also argued that Obama had no experience and was going to make a complete botch of things. As he listened to Ted try to defend Obama, Bobby got hot under the collar and started pointing his finger in his uncle's face. He kept saying over and over, "If you don't listen to me, you're going to regret it." When Ted tried to explain his position, Bobby interrupted, saying, "Obama talks about clean coal. There's no such thing as clean coal." His brothers, Max and Joe, had to intervene and urge him to drop the argument. During the luncheon, Ted proposed a toast to Obama, not once, but twice. He spoke feelingly, but from a seated position, because he no longer had the strength to stand. Caroline joined her uncle's toast, even though she had developed some early misgivings about Obama's team of advisors. During a recent meeting of Obama's aides at Ted's home in the Kalorama section of Washington, D.C., Caroline had offered several ideas about education reform to Arne Duncan, Obama's Secretary of Education. Duncan listened politely but seemed unimpressed by Caroline's point of view. She wasn't used to people ignoring her suggestions, and she was still smarting from the experience. Nonetheless, Caroline offered a few words of praise for Obama. She spoke about how hard he had worked for his election. She said that Obama was serious about ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Bobby sat there fuming. He had always found Caroline too smug for his taste. Her words angered him, and he squeezed his fluted glass so hard that it shattered in his hand, shocking everyone and causing a sudden silence. 2 months later, Ted Kennedy was dead, and for the first time in more than 75 years, the Klan was without a chieftain. In Ted's place, power was split among three cousins: Joseph P. Kennedy II, a former congressman who ran Citizens Energy Corp., a nonprofit oil company; Robert Kennedy Jr., the environmental activist and syndicated talk show host; and Caroline Kennedy, the most famous and popular living Kennedy of all. For the most part, Joe Kennedy remained mum about the Obama administration, leaving it to his brother Bobby to make fiery speeches attacking the president for his environmental policies. That left Caroline, who had showered Obama with all her prestige and celebrity. She was the only Kennedy who had reason to expect something in return from Obama, and she didn't waste any time asking for a plum appointment. Since Caroline's abortive run for the United States Senate from New York, she had lost all interest in elective office. But she wanted to secure a position as an advisor on education to the new administration. With that in mind, she sent the White House a long memo on education funding reform, which was based on her first-hand experience with the New York City Board of Education. She ended the memo by saying she hoped to meet with the president to discuss her ideas. She never got a response, not even an acknowledgement that he had received the memo. Then, in the summer of 2011, Caroline asked Maurice Templesman, her mother's longtime companion and a major player in the Democratic Party, to arrange a meeting with the president and his political advisers on Templesman's 70-foot yacht, the Relamar, which was docked on Martha's Vineyard, where the president was vacationing. It was Caroline's hope that such a meeting would further her late Uncle Teddy's dream of forming a close bond between the Kennedys and the Obamas. Once again, the White House spurned Caroline's overture. The president didn't even make an effort to see Caroline, whose home on Martha's Vineyard, Redgate Farm, was not far from the house the president was renting. A presidential snub had turned into an insult. The White House meted out similar treatment to Ethel Kennedy, the matriarch of the family. During the presidential primaries and general election, Ethel was so gung-ho for Obama that she stopped talking to her son Bobby because he was an Obama critic. After Obama won the election, Ethel invited the new president to stop by her house in the Kennedy compound. Her request was met with stony silence. Ethel was so angry that she went on a rampage inside her house, cursing the president and turning over furniture. "Our family has spies all over the Obama administration," said a member of the Kennedy clan. "There are a lot of Kennedy loyalists from Ted's old office and his connections throughout Washington who are in high positions in the White House agencies. People like Melody Barnes, the director of the Domestic Policy Council, Kenneth Feinberg, the special master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund, James Steinberg, a former deputy secretary of state, and Greg Craig, the former White House counsel under Obama." Through these and other people, Caroline heard back that there was a lot of nasty shit being said about the Kennedys by the president and Michelle, the family member continued. There were catty remarks about how badly the Kennedy women dressed and how their houses were shabby and threadbare. Caroline got the impression that most of this negativity was coming from Michelle, who didn't want the Kennedys to be a part of the administration for fear that they would have too much influence over the president. Gradually, Caroline began to change her tune and side with Bobby and Kathleen Kennedy Townsend against the Obamas. Unlike Jackie, who was completely apolitical, Caroline is liberal with a capital L. When Obama didn't raise taxes to balance the budget, Caroline marked him down. In her eyes, he's a mess because he doesn't follow the liberal Bible on politics. More important, Caroline discovered that the Obamas didn't give a damn about her or her support. For instance, she was not invited to the state dinners at the White House hosted by the Obamas, or to the president's 49th birthday celebration in Chicago. It really annoyed Caroline when comparisons were made by the media between Michelle and Jackie. Caroline had a word for such comparisons. She called them odious. She really got annoyed, and when she began to fall out of love with the Obamas, love was replaced with outright scorn. Now she says things about Obama like, "I can't stand to hear his voice anymore. He's a liar and worse." On Halloween, 2011, Caroline Kennedy received an invitation to attend a reception celebrating the 50th anniversary of the White House Historical Society. She could hardly have been ignored in this case because it was her mother, Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy, who had restored many parts of the White House and established the White House Historical Association in 1961. The reception was closed to the press. Michelle Obama posed for a photo with Caroline, which was released later. But that was it. There was no invitation to the family quarters, where Caroline had lived and played as a child. After the photo, Michelle spun on her heels and left. Caroline said that shaking hands with Michelle was like shaking hands with a cold fish, a close family advisor who talked with Caroline after the White House event said. Caroline had the feeling she wasn't really wanted there. Michelle gave the distinct impression that she doesn't like her. Caroline can be pretty standoffish herself, but she was surprised at how cold Michelle was to her. The only thing personal about the meeting was when Michelle turned to Caroline and said, "The president is going to put that Keystone Pipeline project on hold, and wouldn't Bobby like that?" In response, Caroline said, "Bobby would like to meet with the president about the Keystone Pipeline being not only delayed, but being aggressively attacked and killed." Michelle looked stricken. She said Bobby should call the White House, meaning that he would have to go through channels like everybody else. Caroline's attitude about the 2012 election is that, as a loyal Democrat, she has nowhere to go, no one else to possibly support except Obama. What really pisses her off is that the Obamas know that she has nowhere else to go, so they see no point in being nice to her. Chapter 15. The Jewish Problem with Obama. Jews earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. Milton Himmelfarb. Nothing pleased Barack Obama more than the opportunity to leave his carping critics behind and escape overseas, where his reputation as an amateur had not caught up with him. And so, last November, after bashing the Republicans for failing to pass an expensive jobs bill that he knew in advance would never collect the necessary votes, the embattled president eagerly bounded up the ramp of Air Force One for the 9-hour flight to Cannes in the south of France, where he was scheduled to rub shoulders with presidents, prime ministers, and heads of state at the Group of 20 summit meeting. 3,500 journalists and a fleet of 200 motorcycle escorts were on hand to greet Obama. The city center was locked down by 12,000 security guards and 10,000 metal barriers. Snipers were positioned on top of hotels and all the high points in the city, and divers inspected the port and its boats. Yachts were forbidden to dock off Cannes' famous Boulevard de l'Écossais. The Palais de Festival, which hosts the annual Cannes Film Festival, was booked to accommodate the visiting dignitaries. Photos of Obama mingling with his fellow summiteers and looking like the leader of the free world were transmitted back to the United States, where Obama's handlers hoped they would man up his wussy image. For Obama, the spectacle in Cannes recalled the heady days during the 2008 presidential campaign, when he was treated like the second coming of the Messiah. As he relaxed among friends in the French resort city, years of care seemed to melt from the lines on his face. By the time he sat down with his host, the president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, for a private conversation before a final press conference, Obama was in such a relaxed and jovial mood that he didn't notice the open microphone nearby. His subsequent conversation was recorded by reporters in an adjoining room. "Netanyahu," said Sarkozy, referring to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu. "I can't stand him. He's a liar." To which an unguarded American president replied, "You're sick of him? I have to work with him every day." The publication of Obama's impolitic comment, first reported by a French website and confirmed by the Associated Press, provided a window into the president's true feelings about Bibi Netanyahu and his right-of-center government in Israel. Obama entered office with the professed goal of bringing about an independent Palestinian state before the end of his first term, and he blamed Netanyahu, rather than his own misguided policies and the pitfalls of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, for preventing him from reaching that objective. Just 6 months before the Cannes summit, Obama had set off a firestorm in Israel by calling upon the Jewish state to accept its 1967 borders, with agreed-upon land swamps as a basis for resuming negotiations with the Palestinians. Along with most Israelis, Netanyahu was shocked and appalled by Obama's display of rank amateurism in the art of diplomatic negotiations. Like previous Israeli prime ministers, Netanyahu was prepared to negotiate on the basis of the 1967 borders, but he wasn't so naive that he would give away that key negotiating point without demanding that the Palestinians first agree to recognize the legitimacy of the State of Israel. As a result, Netanyahu rejected Obama's initiative, handing the American president yet another foreign policy setback, and sinking relations between Washington and Jerusalem to their lowest point since the administration of Jimmy Carter. This, in turn, had serious domestic consequences for Obama's relations with one of his key political constituencies, the American Jewish community. Jewish voters, wrote Erica Werner of the Associated Press, though comprising only 2% of the electorate nationwide, are an important part of Obama's base and could make a difference in battleground states, including Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Nevada in a close election. Moreover, the Jewish community is an important source of donations, and Obama campaign supporters want to maintain that support as much as Republicans want to chip away at it. In the nearly 80 years since President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, relations between American Jews and the Democratic Party have been as close as lips and teeth. Even as Jews prospered and assimilated into the mainstream of American life, most of them remained loyal to FDR's liberal vision and refrained from following the pattern of other affluent groups by shifting to the Republican Party. Over the course of the past 20 presidential election cycles, a stunning 75% of the Jewish vote has, on average, gone to the Democratic presidential candidate. If further proof of Jewish loyalty on the Democrats were needed, it was provided by the 2008 election of Barack Obama. On a key issue for many Jewish voters, support for Israel, the hawkish John McCain started off with a decisive advantage over Obama, whose past associations with the anti-Semitic Reverend Jeremiah Wright and the Israel-bashing Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi raised troubling questions in the minds of many Jews. And yet, when the vote was tallied, Obama trounced McCain among Jews by a staggering 57-point margin. After decades of involvement in the civil rights movement by American Jews, Obama stirred deep emotions in the Jewish community. Brett Stevens, the deputy editorial page editor of the Wall Street Journal, told the author of this book. The Black-Jewish alliance was shattered in the late 1960s, and Jews have yearned ever since to restore it. Jews felt good about voting for Obama, for not only were they voting for a guy they agreed with and liked, but they were also voting for their own personal redemption. A sizable number of American Jews, however, are having a serious case of buyer's remorse when it comes to Barack Obama. Recent polls of the Jewish community reflect a significant decline in support from 2008, when 78% of Jewish voters pulled the lever for Obama. According to one poll, Obama's approval rating among American Jews has plummeted to 54%. Others, such as a survey of the American Jewish Committee, have cast it even lower. Among the many factors driving down Obama's numbers among Jewish voters was the president's hostile attitude toward businessmen in general, and Wall Street in particular. But what really appeared to irritate American Jews was the president's roughhouse treatment of Israel. As the 2012 presidential election drew near, Obama backed off from some of his public assaults on Israel and hired a high-level Jewish outreach director to smooth over hurt feelings. But Obama was still in trouble with large segments of the Jewish community. The 2011 annual survey by the American Jewish Committee revealed declining Jewish support for Obama. Among its findings, for the first time during Obama's presidency, disapproval among Jewish voters exceeded approval by 48% to 45%. Obama's approval rating among Jews had dropped 10% in the past 12 months. A majority, 53%, disapproved of Obama's handling of Israel-U.S. relations. A plurality of Jews, 45%, disapproved of Obama's handling of the Iran nuclear issue. A majority, 55%, opposed establishing a Palestinian state in the current situation. Malcolm Hohnlein, co-chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, the coordinating body for 52 Jewish groups, estimated that Obama had lost the support of as much as one-third of Jewish voters. Sid Dinerstein, chairman of the Palm Beach County Republican Party, predicted that Obama would be limited to around 60% of the Jewish vote in 2012. While these estimates are just that, predictions, there is no denying the fact that many Jews are so annoyed with the Obama administration that they have closed their wallets and are seriously thinking of sitting out the 2012 election. President Barack Obama's Chicago-based re-election